Hey, welcome to the Sober Buddy podcast, your boost of sober thinking and awesome life building. I'm Tara Zoe, CEO and co-founder here at Sober Buddy, and I am joined by Laura Cathcart Robbins, author of the book Stash, My Life in Hiding. Laura's story offers a unique perspective on addiction. As an affluent Black woman with a Hollywood exec husband, a home in Malibu, president of the PTA, and sons who adored her, Laura struggled with a secret addiction, and I am super excited to get into her story. But first, remember to download and subscribe to the Sober Buddy app. We have Zoom groups twice a day, Monday through Friday, hosted by your favorite Sober Buddy team members, a thriving and supportive community, bite-sized challenges to teach you sober skills, and an exciting confetti sober tracker. And there's even a free trial, so you can check it out and see if it's right for you. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm excited you're here too. I think that I want to know your story. You know, I just like want to know how this all came about, because your addiction was pain pills, correct?
It was actually Ambien.
Okay, Ambien. Okay, sleeping pills. So tell me about when the Ambien came into your life, kind of how that started.
Well, I think it started rather innocuously. I was a brand new mom to two boys that I'd had back to back. Spirited, I think is what we're supposed to call boys like mine now. they were a lot of energy. They had a lot of energy rather, and they took a lot of energy from me, and I wasn't able to sleep at night, and I was prescribed Ambien to take by my general practitioner.
Right.
And it worked really well for me. I was able to get a full night's sleep. I woke up rested. But I also, the first one I took, I took it, I was waiting for it to work. I felt it working. And then the next thing I knew, it was morning.
Oh, wow.
And my first thought was, again, please. Like, I want to have that again.
I want to be completely out of this world right now.
Yes. Yeah. And I knew there was something wrong with that thinking. Mm. I knew that the again, please should be about my actual life and not about getting away from it via sleep. I had not yet. I wasn't drinking alcoholically at the time. I was not aware that I was dealing with addiction in my life. I didn't know that I was an addict. So this was not something that I used addictively for a while. I had a bottle of 30 that I kept for a year and I took them every once in a while, but I look forward to those times
it was
so
like,
much.
I'm gonna give myself my little treat of Ambien.
My little treat, and I can check out. And, you know, eventually, because I didn't get any pushback from my doctor, I started taking them more frequently, and then it was every day. And then, you know, I say when I talk about this that I crossed an invisible line where it just, whatever the tolerance was that my body had, it built up more. And I wasn't able to just take one as prescribed. I needed two in order to get to sleep. I would wake up in the middle of the night and need another one to go back to sleep. And so I was taking quite a few Ambien, and the withdrawal from them, which I didn't see coming, was just horrific.
What was that like? What is an Ambien withdrawal like?
It's a benzo withdrawal. So if anyone's familiar with Klonopin or Valium or Xanax, I mean, I think we're all familiar with those brand names, but if you have taken them and then tried to get off of them, if you've taken them regularly for any length of time, what usually happens is it's, for me, it was like the flu, like a really bad flu. There were body aches, brain zaps. I was really, really anxious, like over the top anxious all the time. And I couldn't sleep. I was literally in pain. I was nauseous. I had headaches, like the worst headaches you can imagine. I had night sweats. So it was a really, really unpleasant state to be in. So at that point, I kind of ramped up to make sure that I was never in that state, which meant that I had to be kind of loaded all the time.
Right. So when you started having these kind of withdrawals, did it make you did it kind of put off a warning signal in your head? Like, oh my gosh, am I addicted to these or dependent?
Yes. Yes, it did. But, you know, I had a really thick blanket of denial as well. So as soon as those warning signs would come in, like I call them my three horsemen: rationalization, justification, and minimization.
Love that.
And they would come right in and be like, but it can't be so bad. The doctor, you're only getting them from the doctor, and no one knows, and no one's ever said anything to you. So, and you always hear, you know, all these PTA moms talking about their Xanax, and they pass it around at the table when we go to lunch. So it can't be that bad. This is just something you need to kind of get under control.
Right, right. And I think that's an important thing to talk about, because that happened a lot with the opioid thing, right? It was like, it's harder to realize you know, have an addiction. There's so much awareness now about it, but it was like, well, my doctor's giving it to me. It's in the prescription bottle. You know, everyone's taking it. Maybe like, oh, I have a pill here. If you're in pain, here, take it. You know, like it was just not concerning to anyone. And then all of a sudden, bam, it's out of control, right?
So, absolutely. I was always one of those people too. Like I'm almost 5'9". I was 96 pounds all through my teens. My early 20s, I finally like cracked 100 and gained a little bit more weight. And so I've always had a really fast metabolism. Mm. I could drink more than my counterparts, even though I was really thin. My metabolism was just like chugging along like a machine. So I always thought I needed more of everything else than everybody else did. And in fact, when I had my first kid, I was like, you're going to need to give me more of that Demerol or whatever it is than you do most people, because it just goes right through my system.
Interesting. So it was kind of like part of your justification cycle was that, well, I need more because I burn more. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And I really thought that was a belief of mine, that I was different. I was unique in that way.
And then, so how long did this go on?
So the Ambien use went on for years. The addiction, probably 3 years.
And then, so did it start to escalate and start to cause problems in your life in general? Like start to affect different areas of your life?
Oh, yeah. It escalated. It, you know, it became like the one thing, the one focus in my life. And like you said, I was in a high profile marriage, and I was the PTA president, which is the Parent Teachers Association president. I had two kids who had very active after school lives. So there was sports, there was tutoring, there were play dates. That's what we call them then. I don't know if they still do.
Yes, but it is still the term.
So those are all things that I was in charge of. I was in charge of these committees during the day. And then I was in charge of my kids after school. And then there was, you know, homework and dinner and all of that. So whatever I needed, whatever I was doing, as I was doing all that. And also, I never missed a workout. I played tennis twice a week. So I was showing up for my life. But in order to show up, I needed to have something in my system. So it was all math and like amateur pharmacy, like just trying to figure out what dosage I would need to get to this event and how long I would need to be there before I could get another dosage and not look like I was loaded, but also not look like I was in withdrawal, because those two things would be huge tells.
So then your life kind of starts to really, like, you're always thinking
of
the drug that you're taking, right?
Oh, I mean, it was always top of mind. It was, I had someone describe it the other day. I thought this was such a great description of like having low grade diarrhea all the time.
So you're having
all you're thinking about is getting to the bathroom, right? You're having all these conversations. You're thinking like, is it in my pants? Can anybody see? Like, and you just want to get to the bathroom. It's a really gross example.
Yeah, but I think it's a really vivid like understanding of how much you would be thinking of that. I think that's a great example.
Preoccupation and I gotta tell you, Tara, it is still like it's embossed on me. Like I feel it still. And now it's 14 years later.
That's crazy.
But I can still feel in my body how that felt when I was in that state.
It's crazy how much the body just remembers
what
it's addicted to. You know, it's just like, it can ingrain on us. You know, the body's powerful. It's really powerful. And so did anybody else start to notice this? Did it like your husband and is he still your husband or are you guys no longer together?
Yeah, no, he's my ex-husband. You know, I think I was really good at hiding it. Right before I went to treatment, which was in July of 2008, I told him that I needed to go and I told him why. And he was very supportive, which to me, he didn't ask me any questions.
like what? It wasn't You're a shocker to him then? Maybe he did notice and he didn't say anything?
I think what was happening was he really suspected that there was something going on. And we were in the middle of a divorce. We were almost divorced at that point. But I think he really suspected there was something going on, you know, because I did drink to boost the Ambien at night after everyone was asleep, but I didn't drink during the day. So it wasn't like smelling like booze or any of the other kind of telltale signs that one might find. You know, they were little teeny pills. I could put them in my pocket. I could take a corner before I walked into a meeting. Mm. I say a corner if I break them up into like three parts. And
because you did your math for your dosage.
Exactly. And I'm horrible at math. I don't know how I ended up doing that.
That is another like testament to the power of the addiction is you were willing to like math it out.
Yes, totally. So yeah, he was that support showed me that he was aware of something. My parents had no idea. My close friends were shocked. Some of them are still shocked. because a few of them are early readers of my book. Mm. And they're reading about themselves. You know, I use my friends' real names in the book with their permission. And they had no idea what was going on.
They didn't know the other side of that situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's
so cool. I could teach a master class in hiding your addiction.
You know what's so funny is I think most people who have had an addiction could do that. Like, you know, like when they're like, okay, here's how I did it. And you're like, shh, don't tell everybody. Let them figure it out on their own.
Exactly.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And so you're going, and I think it's interesting because you talk about having a unique perspective for a Black woman. And I think that this is an important topic to bring up of like people tend to see addiction and Black women in a certain way and how you're saying, no, there's another side to this that I want to represent.
Well, absolutely. I say this, I've said this before, I have the privilege of coming from a place of privilege. Mm-hmm. So my experience, you know, there were a few movies about Black women and addiction that had done well. Mm-hmm. There were a few books about Black women and addiction that had also done well. But in almost every single one of those instances, the Black woman was a prostitute who had basically come from nothing, who, you know, sexual abuse, like all these things, which are really valid, important stories.
Right.
And then come into their recovery. But those stories weren't my story. Right. I didn't have that story. And I really wanted to see what someone who looked like me, because for me, in these spaces that I occupied, my children's school, where I was the PTA president, where I've been asked to join the board of trustees, where I still sit all these years later, ex officio, not officially on the board, but I'm still part of it. I was the only Black person in those spaces in many cases. My kids didn't have Black classmates. My older one, not until fourth grade.
Wow.
And so the counterpart is there weren't Black parents either. So and I was the only Black. Yeah.
I'm curious. Was there something in that made you want to hide your addiction more? Because you didn't want some kind of stigma to be set on you. Like, oh, you know, I'm making a stigma or something of that sort.
Yeah. I mean, there's a part in the book where I'm asked to be the parent association president and the word kind of spreads through the community because I'm the first Black parent association since 1974, in 2008. And a Black mom comes up to me and says, you know, you're representing us all now, you know? And I was like, I do. but get your finger out of my face. Yeah. But yeah,
like, don't put that on me.
But she was right. Whether I liked it or not, I was the de facto ambassador for all Black people there. As they were coming into the school, I was the representative. And for the people who weren't Black, I was the representative. I needed to represent Black excellence wherever I went. It wasn't enough to be as good as anybody else. I really had to be better. Right. So that I could be accepted. And I was fully aware that I was seen as exceptional, meaning that I was the exception is to like, who's safe and, oh, she's right. great, you know, and we don't ever think of you as Black.
Oh, wow.
Which is an insult for anyone yes. who doesn't know that. Please see my color and do think of me as Black. But that those kind of things were said a lot. And I really felt the weight of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. And so we talked about you saying, I'm going to go, did you go to inpatient treatment or did you do outpatient?
I did.
Okay. So yeah. Was there some kind of an incident that clicked you over there that you were like, I have to go into treatment? Because that's a big step.
It was a big step. And there were many incidents that should have clicked me over to you need to go to treatment. There were many. You know, Robin Williams had that really great saying that he was compromising his standards faster than he could lower them.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I was doing that. I was like, I'm never going to, you know, take a pill before 8 p.m. And then I was taking it at 7:30. Like I was just, I kept adjusting the bar per my addiction, basically.
Right.
And so I was compromising myself and getting closer and closer and closer to being caught by somebody, which was my greatest fear.
Right.
But really why I went to treatment was on the 4th of July of 2008, I was with my kids. We were in our Malibu home and I hadn't brought anything with me, any drugs with me, because I had a stash there. Hence the name of the book, Stash. I had a stash there that I knew that I could, you know, source while I was there. And I got to Malibu and I was already in withdrawal. Like it sped up. I was in a bad state by the time we got there. And I had our neighbors take them to see the fireworks. I wasn't able to take them. Told them I had a headache. And I hated lying, you know,
yeah.
As much as I had to lie to kind of keep up my addiction. I hated lying to my kids. Like that was the worst thing. I mean, I did have a headache, but it was brought on because it was withdrawal. And I found my stash and there was a lot less in it than I thought there was. And I freaked out and I took the whole thing and tried to knock myself out and I couldn't knock out. It just wasn't enough. Sleep. Yeah. And so I knew, I told myself, like, you know, if the point where you can no longer get loaded and you can't be sober, like, well, you can't do those two things. I could not have anything in my system and I couldn't get loaded. And that's the point where I needed to go get help.
Yeah.
And I was there.
It was like all options, both doors were closed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you decide you're going to go to a treatment. Now, let's be honest here. What kind of a treatment center was it? Was it one of these like equine therapy, wonderful treatment centers? Because I feel like that's wonderful that that's an option.
Of course. I mean, look, here, the website, it made it sound like, first of all, they said I could have a private room, which was the only way I was going to treatment.
Right, right.
They lied. I did not have a private room.
They did.
They did. And when I got there, I was like, but it was too late. I was in Wickenburg, Arizona. That's like, you know, for the shout out to Wickenburg if anybody lives there, but it's really what they call a one horse town. There's no airport nearby. There's no way to escape. Once you're there, you're there. And I was there and it was, but it's, you know, it's posh. Yeah. It's like there's a five-star chef and there's a swimming pool and recreational activities. And yeah.
I like that that's an option because we always talk about like barriers to getting help. And that is one of the barriers is that, oh my gosh, I'm going to go to this. You know, it's already hard enough to think I'm going to get sober, you know, and have to give up my, like this great love of my life, right? Like this drug.
Yes.
But also I have to be like super uncomfortable. So knowing that it can feel like, oh, I'm going to go on vacation a little bit while I'm withdrawing.
Yeah.
is, I think, a nice consolation.
Yeah. And there were so many people that were in there with me that felt exactly like that. Mm-hmm. They're like, this is my spa month. And they totally loved it. I hated it.
Yeah.
I hated every second I was there. I'd never been away from my kids that long.
And how old were your kids at this time?
They were little. They were still in elementary school.
That's hard.
So yeah, it was hard. And I was just devastated. Mm-hmm. I was devastated by the whole thing. And, you know, I was like, I should have brought my sheets and my pillowcases. These are terrible. Like I was not impressed. Mm-hmm. I understand now, looking back, how impressive it actually was.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I had never been in anything that communal before. Anywhere. I'm not a joiner, you know, like I'm not like the let's go for a girls weekend girl.
Okay.
And everybody sleeps in the same room or whatever. Like I don't do that. So this felt distinctly wrong to me to be that unprivate.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
That is a big thing, you know, that kind of just understanding of different things. I was never like that. I was like, I could have 15 girls in the room, but I had all sisters. I had a bunch of sisters, you know, so I was used to that. So,
right.
So you're there. And were you there for 30 days? Was that a 30-day program or longer?
It could be absolutely be a longer program. They wouldn't commit to me actually how long I was going to be there, which was another thing. I was like, I'm leaving after 30. So
right. They
can say whatever they want. But I was there for 30 days. You know, I checked in and I was in an orientation. I had also snuck in a lot of drugs.
Okay. And that's common. Everybody, that's common. We do not recommend this, but we all know that this is also very common. So did they catch you with those or did you just end up going through them and then having to withdraw after that? Okay.
Yes. I'm nodding for those of you who can't hear me, see me rather. I went through them. It actually wasn't as much as I thought I was sneaking in because I kept kind of chipping away at them
before
I went. So I'm muddy on all that. I don't really remember checking in so much. But I was in an orientation when I first got there and I was thinking about what I had snuck in and I was really preoccupied with that. And then I just had a panic attack and decided to leave. I was not going to stay there. And I ran out and this guy ran after me. And, you know, handed me the sweatshirt that I had left in the back. And he was another patient, which I didn't know at first. I thought he worked there. And he was to start talking to me about his daughters and asked me where I was from, told me he was sorry to hear about my divorce. And I was so irritated with him.
You're like, leave me alone. Like,
get away from me. And anyway, he ended up being like my support person while I was there. And he's here right now. He just left the room, but 14 years later, we are together.
Like you're a couple?
We're a couple.
Okay. We say this? Are you romantically involved?
Yeah. Yeah. We weren't then.
Yeah.
But we obviously are now because we live together.
Yeah.
we've raised our children together.
That's great. You know, there's mixed emotions about the whole rehab romance, but you weren't in a romance
We were not in a romance in rehab. No, actually we didn't move in together for 6 years. We really did. We had a batting order, which was our recovery first, our respective families, his kids, my kids second, and then our respective parents at that time too. And then everything else, including each other, was third.
Yeah.
So that's how we lived those first 6 years. So we could make sure that our recovery was solid enough to be together.
Yeah. And that's so key. It's nice that you were able to stick to that and to just really value your growth and your personal change on that level, because that sets everything else up for success long-term.
Yeah. Well, and like I said, I can remember the feelings of withdrawal so well. I remember the terror. I don't just remember it. I feel it. Mm-hmm. I had a lot at stake. Yeah. You know, I had just gone through a divorce. I had the custody of my children at stake. I had my freedom at stake. You know, once I was sober, I was free of this thing that had mastered me for all that time. And I understood that anything that led me back to that was a risk for me that I really couldn't afford to take that risk.
Yeah. Yeah.
And thank goodness I understood that right away. I didn't like it at all, but I really, it was clear for me. And I think because the pain was so fresh and terrible, I spent 11 days in detox, in a medical detox and treatment. Because I was so progressed and so addicted. And they needed to make sure that I got off safely. I didn't sleep the whole time, except for like maybe, you know, 10 or 15 minutes here or there. I never slept an hour until after those 11 days. And so I had a really hard time. He was the least of my concerns while I was there. But he was a really nice support person for me. I wouldn't have stayed there if he hadn't been there. I know that for sure.
That's amazing. It's amazing how our stories come together like that. You know, you never know where it's going to take that twist and turn and work out.
Yes.
That's really cool. So you came out, and then when you came out, I mean, you were there 30 days, you said?
I was.
Okay. Yeah. So you come out and you have to kind of start this fresh life, right? Because you've just been divorced. You've got, you know, so what kind of was your like building yourself back kind of growth there?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, and I'm not trying to scare anybody off, my first year was terrible. I was still scared. As much as I had been scared about getting caught, I was still scared about who knows what, how much do they know? How are they looking at me now? Are they judging me? I was terrified of every room that I walked into. I did go to meetings right away because that had been, I got into therapy with a therapist that had been recommended by the Meadows is where I went. So it was by the Meadows here in LA where I live. And so I did those two things. I ended up, you know, probably going to 3 meetings a day on the days where I could, if I had parent association, because I was still the parent association president.
And so you probably had this major imposter syndrome then, right?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I don't think I was aware of that then. I really just knew that I didn't want people to find out who I really was. Because I was like, how could they want me to be the PA president if I like wouldn't I'm sure they want to take it back now and ask somebody who didn't spend their summer in rehab to be the parent association president.
And did they know, or were you just afraid they would find out?
I think for the most part no one knew. I went over the summer. It was everybody was gone. You know, they were like, you know, and when they came back, when we came back at the beginning of the school year, you know, I was in my regular form of PA president. So I was able to show up and look like the same person I was before I went. Mm-hmm. So for them, I don't know if it skipped so much of a beat as it did for me.
Right.
For me, it felt really, everything felt very exposing and raw. But I, like I said, I did go to meetings. Like 3 a day. Scott had gone back to Utah. That's my boyfriend. He was from Utah. So he went back to Utah. I was in LA. And we talked on the phone every night, you know, just like rehashing our days and being scared together, you know. But it was really, I felt like I got out of treatment and someone pulled a fire alarm in my head and it went off for a year. And it really wasn't until I took that year cake where it quieted down, like I was able to turn the volume down on it a little bit. Not everything was so scary. Not everything was so urgent. I had gone through all those 1 year anniversaries. Like I remember being loaded when I was here at this game because I was, you know, my kids play basketball and I was at this game and this gym and gone through, you know, the holidays, which are bookended by my kids' birthdays. And so gone through all those anniversaries, which were very shameful to me at the time, reflecting back on how I showed up for them the year before. And I got through them that first year sober. And I really did feel, someone asked me to sponsor them in my recovery circle that I go to. And I, which meant, you know, to kind of guide them through the work that I did to get sober. And I said yes, even though I just, like, talk about imposter syndrome. I did not feel like I was equipped. I didn't remember anything about anything ever. I was just like going through the motions, but that really focused me in. And I started, things started to quiet down for me.
Yeah.
And I could relax into it.
I love that, of the idea of, you know, doing things sober. Like, when you can do a thing sober, then you're proving to yourself, you're saying, I can do this sober.
Yeah.
When I didn't before. And it just builds that extra step of belief. And I think that I like how you put that, like, with the, you know, through the year, you did everything that you did the year before that you were ashamed of in, like, a sober way. And then that, that proved it to you.
Totally. Yeah.
So if you were, you're talking about being a sponsor and, like, not knowing any, you know, what to tell this person. So if you were talking to a person right now who was either, like, thinking about going into sobriety or early in their recovery and really struggling, what would you say would be, like, the big piece of advice that you would give them?
Well, for one, I try not to give advice.
Smart.
I find that, because I love to give advice. Giving advice is, like, one of my favorite things to do, but especially in recovery, it just doesn't land very well. So what I found is better for me is to give my experience, or offer my experience if someone wants it. And usually I wait for someone to ask me for my experience with something, and then I offer it to them. So
So let's rephrase this. We're going to reframe this question now. So what would you say was the, like, one of the big things that helped you in those early times to keep going?
One, my gift of desperation, which cannot be purchased. It cannot be given to anybody. I came in really desperate, and it was the worst. But it was also the best, because it, for me, there wasn't another option at that time. I would also say to really, you know, speaking of 12-step groups, which is how I got sober and where, how I'm still sober. I'm still sober as a result of my engagement in those groups. To find one where you can see yourself reflected back in the rooms, to find inclusive groups, to find ones where you, whatever your identities are, you know, my many identities, I'm Black, I'm female, I'm a writer and a podcaster for a living, I'm a mom, I'm a partner, I'm a daughter. Those can all kind of fade to the background. And what I need to treat, which is, you know, depending on who you're talking into, alcohol use disorder, substance abuse disorder, or alcoholism, which is what I choose to call it. But I can just go into those rooms and treat that. And I don't have to be all those other things in that moment.
Yeah.
And so to find rooms or spaces, and it certainly doesn't have to be 12-step. There are lots of ways to get sober, especially right now.
Yeah.
There's so many different groups and so many options, but find your people in wherever you go and connect with them.
For sure.
You know, for sure. I was terrified to get Black women's phone numbers when I first came in. They were the women that I needed to help me get sober. I needed to have my experience reflected back to me in that way. And so that was really helpful for me. I also needed other parents. It was really important for me to have other moms and dads. There were a few dads that were really helpful, but I needed to find those meetings where I could find those people.
Tell me about your book.
It launches on March 7th of 2023. So it's a memoir. And I like to describe it of where addiction, race, and privilege intersect. And it's about 10 months of my life from March of 2008 to December of 2008. I think that's 10 months. I told you I'm bad at math.
it's around there.
But it's around there. It's around there. So it's a very short period of my life, but it's about my bottom in my addiction. It's about the end of my marriage. It's about me, you know, the only connection I never lost during that whole time was the one with my kids and my mm-hmm. fight to maintain it and grow it and to be a mom. It's about meeting Scott mm-hmm. in treatment and what that looked like for us after we went back to our respective cities. Mm-hmm. And it's about really finding and falling in love with myself.
I love that. I love that. Well, I'm looking forward to reading it. I know that it sounds incredible. I do like that it has this whole interwoven depth to it. Now, your friends that were in it,
yes.
question, and they're reading your manuscript. And
yes.
did you have like really cool conversations with them afterwards about all of the kind of topics you bring up?
No.
Well, there you go.
Great question, though. No, that's not true. I had dinner with one of the woman who was my best friend at the time, who is still my very dear friend. We had dinner the other night and we talked about it, about how she experienced that time period in my life and how she experiences me now. And that juxtaposition of really what she felt for me, I just ghosted everyone. Mm. Because no one knew what was going on, they attributed it to the divorce.
Okay. Okay.
And assumed that because I was having a hard time with the divorce, I was either depressed I was depressed and just isolating. Mm. And so to not know that other piece of what was going on, which was maybe the biggest piece mm. of what was going on, was really difficult for her to find out.
Yeah.
And I had told them all briefly what had happened.
But when you told them, were you like, oh, like, did you tell them like you've resolved it all? It's fine now.
No. Okay. I it was tearful and it was good. I need to let you guys know what's been going on. This was after I got sober, but before I was a year. So I told them all, but I write in such detail about what happens. It's very sensorial. Like, I drop you right into my body. So it moves very fast and you feel like you're running from place to place with me. Mm. So I think that was what really got her, was like, I get it now. And I wish I got it then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Has there been anybody since you've come out about your recovery?
Yeah.
Has there been anybody in your life that they then said, oh, I have a problem too?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people, but you know, no one in my immediate circle, like I have a pretty close circle of about 10 to 15 people.
Yeah.
None of them.
Okay.
None of them, but people kind of on the fringes, the periphery, have come forward. I had a gentleman who owns a local restaurant, really sweet guy, who follows me on Instagram apparently, and he DM'd me because his daughter is in her addiction and needs help. Mm. And he's seen my post about my recovery.
Yeah.
I was the only person that he could think to ask because he doesn't really know anyone else.
Right. Or he doesn't think he's not aware.
He doesn't think he knows.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That's something that has really come up since I started Sober Buddy, is like, you know, the second I say what I do, it always is going to bring up the conversation, you know? And so many people have just like felt that they could open up all of a sudden about addiction and either themselves or, you know, someone very close to them, and just one, you know, feeling safe all of a sudden with this big secret. It's funny. And this happens with mental health too. And I love that we're getting more and more open about it all, that the stigma is going away. But with mental health too, I remember I had one of my employees when I was in sales, he told me that his son, they had been diagnosed with schizophrenia. And he was like in his 20s. And how he talked about how it's crazy, like 1 in 6 people have a mental health disorder. And so it's like actually so common that mm-hmm. we know someone or we ourselves have an issue, but no one's allowed to talk about it. And It's like this huge stigma. It's like so shaming, even though we're all dealing with it.
Right.
And so I think that that starts to come out, and it's just crazy that, you know, 1 in 10 people have an, you know, have substance use disorder. So it's like so common.
It really is. And you're right there, because of the stigma, we don't talk about it. And it's, you know, and alcohol and drug use, but mainly alcohol use, is so glorified mm-hmm. in the media. It's looks very cool and glamorous and necessary.
Right.
You know, when you are celebrating or grieving, you drink, period.
Right.
That's the first thing you do.
It's like the auto response. Yeah. We've talked about this a lot on social media, but it's like the only drug you have to justify not doing.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, exactly. You're not doing cocaine tonight?
Yeah, I've seen so many posts where especially women and moms, they'll substitute heroin for the word alcohol, and they'll be like, oh my God, I'm so stressed. Let's do some heroin, you know? And so, and just to like give perspective, you know,
I love that. I've actually never heard that. Yeah, that's great.
They'll say like, they're all drugs. You know, our, Megan, our social media manager, I saw she posted the other day. She said, drugs and alcohol. Oh, let's just stop lying and say drugs. Like, yes. Let's just stop the lie.
I think I saw that.
Okay.
I think I saw that post. Yeah.
And I was like, well played. Yeah. It's true. It's like, this is a drug, and we've branded it. The alcohol companies, right. I'm sure, has rebranded it as something different than a drug, but it is a drug. And so when you substitute other words, I think it puts things into perspective.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And alcohol, for the record, is a drug. So yes. There's that.
Officially, it is a mind-altering, addictive substance that kills 88,000 people a year in the U.S.
Thank you. Thank you.
Just FYI, everybody.
Right? Don't get it twisted.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I just want to do a little side note here, that 88,000 people does not include things like car accidents or other secondary issues from alcohol. So the drinking of alcohol and what it does to your body is what's killing 88,000 people. So, and also that's more people than we lost in the Vietnam War.
Wow.
So every year.
Yeah. So when you put it like that.
Yes. So it's just a good PSA in perspective of like how dangerous alcohol is. And, mm-hmm. you know, and, we obviously know opioids and fentanyl and all that's doing, but, well, I am excited to read your book. And your podcast, The Only One in the Room. I can see that behind you there, the podcast. Tell us, give me 2 minutes on your podcast, because I want to tell everybody about that as well.
Great. Hen, will you come join me for a second?
Oh, yeah.
I was just talking about you.
Oh, hi.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Scott Slaughter. He's the producer and my co-host in the podcast.
Okay.
I call him Hen.
I didn't have my hair done for this, but
it's fine. It's fine. It's mostly audio. It's fine.
So the podcast is called The Only One in the Room, and it started as a result of me going to a 3-day writer's retreat, which is something I said I don't like to do. Because it's very communal. But I went to this retreat. There were 600 people, and I was the only Black one.
Nice.
So I wrote about that experience for the Huffington Post or HuffPo, and the article went viral. I thought all these Black people are going to be like, sister, we see you, we got it. Like, we know that feeling. And there were a lot of them that did, but truly it was responses from all races, from all over the world. My inbox was immediately filled with messages, like to the brim, all of them, my DMs, everything, with people who said, I know what it's like to feel alone in a room full of people. Mm. And so Scott and I decided to create a podcast where we could tell those stories.
That is awesome. I love that. So everybody check out Laura's podcast, check out her book, and then what's your social? We'll put it in the show notes, but give a little shout out.
I'm at Laura Cathcart Robbins. It'll be in the show notes. So that's good, because no one knows how to spell Cathcart, but it's C-A-T-H-C-A-R-T, C-A-T-H-C-A-R-T, and Robbins with 2 B's and an S, Robbins.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I think that everyone's going to enjoy listening to this. And if you're struggling right now in your recovery, take it one moment, one day at a time. You can reach out for other resources. Go on the Sober Buddy app. There's tons of support there. And we believe your life can be better than it's ever been before. So have a great one. And thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much, Tara.